Sand Kings. Simon Cress lived alone in a sprawling manor house among the dry, rocky hills 50 kilometers from the city. So, when he was called away unexpectedly on business, he had no neighbors he could conveniently impose on to take his pets. The carrion hawk was no problem. It roosted in the unused belfry, and customarily fed itself anyway. The shambler Cress simply shooed outside and left to fend for itself. The little monster would gorge on slugs and birds and rock jocks. But the fish tank, stocked with genuine earth piranha, posed a difficulty. Cress finally just threw a haunch of beef into the huge tank. The piranha could always eat one another if he were detained longer than expected. They'd done it before. It amused him. Unfortunately, he was detained much longer than expected this time. When he finally returned, all the fish were dead. So was the carrion hawk. The shambler had climbed up to the belfry and eaten it. Simon Cress was vexed. The next day he flew his skimmer to Asgard, a journey of some 200 kilometers. Asgard was Baldur's largest city, and boasted the oldest and largest starport as well. Cress liked to impress his friends with animals that were unusual, entertaining, and expensive. Asgard was the place to buy them. This time, though, he had poor luck. Xenopets had closed its doors. Tetherane, the pet seller, tried to foist another carrion hawk off on him, and Strange Waters offered nothing more exotic than piranha, glow sharks, and spider squids. Cress had had all those. He wanted something new. Near dusk, he found himself walking down the Rainbow Boulevard, looking for places he had not patronized before. So close to the starport, the street was lined by importers' marts. The big corporate emporiums had impressive long windows, where rare and costly alien artifacts reposed on felt cushions against dark drapes that made the interiors of the stores a mystery. Between them were the junk shops, narrow, nasty little places whose display areas were crammed with all manner of off-world bric-a-brac. Cress tried both kinds of shop with equal dissatisfaction. Then he came across a store that was different. It was quite close to the port. Cress had never been there before. The shop occupied a small, single-story building of moderate size, set between a euphoria bar and a temple brothel of the secret sisterhood. Down this far, the Rainbow Boulevard grew tacky. The shop itself was unusual, arresting. The windows were full of mist, now a pale red, now the gray of true fog, now sparkling and golden. The mist swirled and eddied and glowed faintly from within. Cress glimpsed objects in the window, machines, pieces of art, other things he could not recognize. But he could not get a good look at any of them. The mists flowed sensuously around them, displaying a bit of first one thing and then another, then cloaking all. It was intriguing. As he watched, the mist began to form letters, one word at a time. Cress stood and read, "Woe and Shade. Importers. Artifacts. Art. Life forms. And M-I-S-C." The letters stopped. Through the fog, Cress saw something moving. That was enough for him. That and the word life forms in their advertisement. He swept his walking cloak over his shoulder and entered the store. Inside, Cress felt disoriented. The interior seemed vast, much larger than he would have guessed from the relatively modest frontage. It was dimly lit, peaceful. The ceiling was a starscape, complete with spiral nebulae. Very dark and realistic, very nice. The counters all shone faintly, the better to display the merchandise within. The aisles were carpeted with ground fog. In places it came almost to his knees and swirled about his feet as he walked. Can I help you? She seemed almost to have risen from the fog. Tall and gaunt and pale, she wore a practical gray jumpsuit and a strange little cap that rested well back on her head. Are you Woe or Shade? Cress asked. Or only sales help?
Jala Woe, ready to serve you, she replied. Shade does not see customers. We have no sales help.
You have quite a large establishment, Cress said. Odd that I have never heard of you before.
We have only just opened this shop on Baldur, the woman said. We have franchises on a number of other worlds, however. What can I sell you? Art, perhaps? You have the look of a collector. We have some fine Nortalish crystal carvings.
No, Simon Cress said. I own all the crystal carvings I desire. I came to see about a pet.
A life form?
Yes.
Alien?
Of course.
We have a mimic in stock. From Celia's world. A clever little simian. Not only will it learn to speak, but eventually it will mimic your voice, inflections, gestures, even facial expressions.
Cute, said Cress. And common. I have no use for either, Woe. I want something exotic, unusual, and not cute. I detest cute animals. At the moment, I own a shambler, imported from Kotho, at no mean expense. From time to time, I feed him a litter of unwanted kittens. That is what I think of cute. Do I make myself understood? Woe smiled enigmatically.
Have you ever owned an animal that worshipped you? She asked.
Cress grinned. Oh, now and again. But I don't require worship, Woe. Just entertainment.
You misunderstood me, Woe said, still wearing her strange smile. I meant worship literally.
What are you talking about?
I think I have just the thing for you, Woe said. Follow me.
She led Cress between the radiant counters and down a long, fog-shrouded aisle beneath false starlight. They passed through a wall of mist into another section of the store and stopped before a large plastic tank. An aquarium, thought Cress. Woe beckoned. He stepped closer and saw that he was wrong. It was a terrarium. Within lay a miniature desert about 2 meters square, pale and bleached scarlet by wan red light. Rocks, basalt and quartz and granite. In each corner of the tank stood a castle. Cress blinked and peered and corrected himself. Actually, only 3 castles stood. The fourth leaned, a crumbled, broken ruin. The other 3 were crude but intact, carved of stone and sand. Over their battlements and through their rounded porticos, tiny creatures climbed and scrambled. Cress pressed his face against the plastic. Insects? He asked.
No, Woe replied. A much more complex life form, more intelligent as well. Considerably smarter than your shambler. They are called Sand Kings.
Insects, Cress said, drawing back from the tank. I don't care how complex they are. He frowned. And kindly don't try to gull me with his talk of intelligence. These things are far too small to have anything but the most rudimentary brains.
They share hive minds, Woe said. Castle minds, in this case. There are only 3 organisms in the tank, actually. The 4th died. You see how her castle has fallen.
Cress looked back at the tank. Hive minds, eh? Interesting. He frowned again. Still, it is only an oversized ant farm. I'd hope for something better.
They fight wars.
Wars? Kress looked again.
Note the colors, if you will, Wo told him. She pointed to the creatures that swarmed over the nearest castle. One was scrabbling at the tank wall. Kress studied it. It still looked like an insect to his eyes, barely as long as his fingernail, six-limbed, with six tiny eyes set all around its body. A wicked set of mandibles clacked visibly, while two long, fine antennae wove patterns in the air. Antennae, mandibles, eyes, and legs were sooty black, but the dominant color was the burnt orange of its armor plating. It's an insect, Kress repeated. It is not an insect,
Wo insisted calmly.
The armored exoskeleton is shed when the Sand King grows larger, if it grows larger. In a tank this size, it won't.
She took Kress by the elbow and led him around the tank to the next castle.
Look at the colors here.
He did. They were different. Here the Sand Kings had bright red armor. Antennae, mandibles, eyes, and legs were yellow. Kress glanced across the tank. The denizens of the third live castle were off-white with red trim. He said.
They wore, as I said,
Wo told him.
They even have truces and alliances. It was an alliance that destroyed the fourth castle in this tank. The blacks were getting too numerous, so the others joined forces to destroy them.
Kress remained unconvinced. Amusing, no doubt. But insects fight wars, too.
Insects do not worship,
Wo said. Eh? Wo smiled and pointed at the castle. Kress stared. A face had been carved into the wall of the highest tower. He recognized it. It was Jala Wo's face.
How? I projected a hologram of my face into the tank, kept it there for a few days. The face of God, you see? I feed them. I am always close. The Sand Kings have a rudimentary psionic sense, proximity telepathy. They sense me and worship me by using my face to decorate their buildings. All the castles have them. See?
They did. On the castle, the face of Jala Wo was serene and peaceful, and very lifelike. Kress marveled at the workmanship. How do they do it?
The foremost legs double as arms. They even have fingers of a sort, three small, flexible tendrils, and they cooperate well, both in building and in battle. Remember, all the mobiles of one color share a single mind.
Tell me more, Kress said. Wo smiled.
The Maw lives in the castle. Maw is my name for her, a pun, if you will. The thing is mother and stomach, both. Female, large as your fist, immobile. Actually, Sand King is a bit of a misnomer. The mobiles are peasants and warriors. The real ruler is a queen. But that analogy is faulty as well. Considered as a whole, each castle is a single hermaphroditic creature.
What do they eat?
The mobiles eat pap, predigested food obtained inside the castle. They get it from the Maw after she has worked on it for several days. Their stomachs can't handle anything else. So if the Maw dies, they soon die as well. The Maw eats anything. You'll have no special expense there. Table scraps will do excellently.
Live food? Kress asked. Woe shrugged.
Each maw eats mobiles from the other castles. Yes.
I am intrigued, he admitted. If only they weren't so small.
Yours can be larger. These Sand Kings are small because their tank is small. They seem to limit their growth to fit available space. If I moved these to a larger tank, they'd start growing again.
My piranha tank is twice this size and vacant. It could be cleaned out, filled with sand.
Woe and Shade would take care of the installation. It would be our pleasure.
Of course, said Kress. I would expect 4 intact castles.
Certainly,
Woe said. They began to haggle about the price. 3 days later, Jala Woe arrived at Simon Kress's estate with dormant Sand Kings and a work crew to take charge of the installation. Woe's assistants were aliens unlike any Kress was familiar with. Squat, broad bipeds with 4 arms and bulging, multifaceted eyes. Their skin was thick and leathery, twisted into horns and spines and protrusions at odd spots upon their bodies. But they were very strong and good workers. Woe ordered them about in a musical tongue that Kress had never heard. In a day, it was done. They moved his piranha tank to the center of his spacious living room, arranged couches on either side of it for better viewing, scrubbed it clean, and filled it 2/3 of the way up with sand and rock. Then they installed a special lighting system, both to provide the dim red illumination the Sand Kings preferred and to project holographic images into the tank. On top, they mounted a sturdy plastic cover with a feeder mechanism built in.
This way, you can feed your Sand Kings without removing the top of the tank, Woe explained. You would not want to take any chances on the mobiles escaping.
The cover also included climate control devices to condense just the right amount of moisture from the air.
You want it dry, but not too dry, Woe said.
Finally, one of the four-armed workers climbed into the tank and dug deep pits in the 4 corners. One of his companions handed the dormant maws over to him, removing them one by one from their frosted cryonic traveling cases. They were nothing to look at. Kress decided they resembled nothing so much as a mottled, half-spoiled chunk of raw meat with a mouth. The alien buried them, one in each corner of the tank. Then they sealed it all up and took their leave.
The heat will bring the maws out of dormancy, Woe said. In less than a week, mobiles will begin to hatch and burrow to the surface. Be certain to give them plenty of food. They will need all their strength until they are well established. I would estimate that you will have castles rising in about 3 weeks.
And my face? When will they carve my face?
Turn on the hologram after about a month, she advised him, and be patient. If you have any questions, please call. Woe and Shade are at your service.
She bowed and left. Kress wandered back to the tank and lit a joystick. The desert was still and empty. He drummed his fingers impatiently against the plastic and frowned. On the 4th day, Kress thought he glimpsed motion beneath the sand, subtle subterranean stirrings. On the 5th day, he saw his first mobile, a lone white. On the 6th day, he counted a dozen of them, whites and reds and blacks. The oranges were tardy. He cycled through a bowl of half-decayed table scraps. The mobiles sensed it at once, rushed to it, and began to drag pieces back to their respective corners. Each color group was very organized. They did not fight. Cress was a bit disappointed, but he decided to give them time. The oranges made their appearance on the 8th day. By then, the other Sand Kings had begun to carry small stones and erect crude fortifications. They still did not war. At the moment, they were only half the size of those he had seen at Woe and Shades. But Cress thought they were growing rapidly. The castles began to rise midway through the second week. Organized battalions of mobiles dragged heavy chunks of sandstone and granite to their corners, where other mobiles were pushing sand into place with mandibles and tendrils. Cress had purchased a pair of magnifying goggles so he could watch them work, wherever they might go in the tank. He wandered around and around the tall plastic walls, observing. It was fascinating. The castles were a bit plainer than Cress would have liked, but he had an idea about that. The next day he cycled through some obsidian and flakes of colored glass along with the food. Within hours, they had been incorporated into the castle walls. The Black Castle was the first completed, followed by the white and red fortresses. The oranges were last, as usual. Cress took his meals into the living room and ate seated on the couch so he could watch. He expected the first war to break out any hour now. He was disappointed. Days passed. The castles grew taller and more grand, and Cress seldom left the tank except to attend to his sanitary needs and answer critical business calls. But the Sand Kings did not war. He was getting upset. Finally, he stopped feeding them. 2 days after the table scraps had ceased to fall from their desert sky, 4 black mobiles surrounded an orange and dragged it back to their maw. They maimed it first, ripping off its mandibles and antennae and limbs, and carried it through the shadowed main gate of their miniature castle. It never emerged. Within an hour, more than 40 orange mobiles marched across the sand and attacked the Black's corner. They were outnumbered by the Blacks that came rushing up from the depths. When the fighting was over, the attackers had been slaughtered. The dead and dying were taken down to feed the Black Maw. Cress, delighted, congratulated himself on his genius. When he put food into the tank the following day, a 3-cornered battle broke out over its possession. The whites were the big winners. After that, war followed war. Almost a month to the day after Jala Woe had delivered the Sand Kings, Cress turned on the hologram projector, and his face materialized in the tank. It turned slowly around and around, so his gaze fell on all 4 castles equally. Cress thought it rather a good likeness. It had his impish grin, wide mouth, full cheeks. His blue eyes sparkled. His gray hair was carefully arrayed in a fashionable side sweep. His eyebrows were thin and sophisticated. Soon enough, the Sand Kings set to work. Cress fed them lavishly, while his image beamed down at them from their sky. Temporarily, the wars stopped. All activity was directed toward worship. His face emerged on the castle walls. At first, all 4 carvings looked alike to him. But as the work continued and Cress studied the reproductions, he began to detect subtle differences in technique and execution. The reds were the most creative, using tiny flakes of slate to put the gray in his hair. The white idol seemed young and mischievous to him, while the face shaped by the blacks, although virtually the same line for line, struck him as wise and beneficent. The orange Sand Kings, as ever, were last and least. The wars had not gone well for them, and their castle was sad compared to the others. The image they carved was crude and cartoonish, and they seemed to intend to leave it that way. When they stopped work on the face, Cress grew quite piqued with them. but there was really nothing he could do. When all the Sand Kings had finished their crest faces, he turned off the hologram and decided that it was time to have a party. His friends would be impressed. He could even stage a war for them, he thought. Humming happily to himself, he began to draw up a guest list. The party was a wild success. Kress invited 30 people, a handful of close friends who shared his amusements, a few former lovers, and a collection of business and social rivals who could not afford to ignore his summons. He knew some of them would be discomfited and even offended by his Sand Kings. He counted on it. Simon Kress customarily considered his parties a failure unless at least one guest walked out in high dudgeon. On impulse, he added Jala Woe's name to his list. "Bring Shade, if you like," he added when dictating her invitation. Her acceptance surprised him just a bit. "Shade, alas, will be unable to attend. He does not go to social functions," Woe added. "As for myself, I look forward to the chance to see how your Sand Kings are doing." Kress ordered them up a sumptuous meal, and when at last the conversation had died down and most of his guests had gotten silly on wine and joysticks, he shocked them by personally scraping their table leavings into a large bowl. "Come, all of you," he told them. "I want to introduce you to my newest pets." Carrying the bowl, he conducted them into his living room. The Sand Kings lived up to his fondest expectations. He had starved them for 2 days in preparation, and they were in a fighting mood. While the guests ringed the tank, looking through the magnifying glasses Kress had thoughtfully provided, the Sand Kings waged a glorious battle over the scraps. He counted almost 60 dead mobiles when the struggle was over. The Reds and Whites, who had recently formed an alliance, emerged with most of the food.
"Kress, you're disgusting," Kath Mullane told him. She had lived with him for a short time 2 years before, until her soppy sentimentality almost drove him mad. "I was a fool to come back here. I thought perhaps you'd changed, wanted to apologize."
She had never forgiven him for the time his shambler had eaten an excessively cute puppy of which she had been fond.
"Don't ever invite me here again, Simon."
She strode out, accompanied by her current lover and a chorus of laughter. His other guests were full of questions. Where did the Sand Kings come from, they wanted to know. "From Woe and Shade Importers," he replied with a polite gesture toward Jala Woe, who had remained quiet and apart through most of the evening. "Why did they decorate their castles with his likeness?" "Because I am the source of all good things. Surely you know that." That brought a round of chuckles. "Will they fight again?" "Of course, but not tonight. Don't worry, there will be other parties." Jad Rakus, who was an amateur xenologist, began talking about other social insects and the wars they fought. "These Sand Kings are amusing, but nothing, really. You ought to read about Terran soldier ants, for instance."
"Sand Kings are not insects," Jala Woe said sharply,
but Jad was off and running, and no one paid her the slightest attention. Kress smiled at her and shrugged. Malata Blaine suggested a betting pool the next time they got together to watch a war, and everyone was taken with the idea. An animated discussion about rules and odds ensued. It lasted for almost an hour. Finally, the guests began to take their leave. Jala Woe was the last to depart. "So," Kress said to her when they were alone, "it appears my Sand Kings are a hit."
"They are doing well," Woe said. "Already they are larger than my own."
"Yes," Kress said, except for the oranges.
I had noticed that, Woe replied. They seem few in number, and their castle is shabby.
Well, someone must lose, Cress said. The oranges were late to emerge and get established. They have suffered for it.
Pardon, said Woe, but might I ask if you are feeding your Sand Kings sufficiently?
Cress shrugged. They diet from time to time. It makes them fiercer. She frowned.
There is no need to starve them. Let them war in their own time, for their own reasons. It is their nature, and you will witness conflicts that are delightfully subtle and complex. The constant war brought on by hunger is artless and degrading.
Simon Cress repaid Woe's frown with interest. You are in my house, Woe, and here I am the judge of what is degrading. I fed the Sand Kings as you advised, and they did not fight.
You must have patience.
No, Cress said. I am their master and their god, after all. Why should I wait on their impulses? They did not war often enough to suit me. I corrected the situation.
I see, said Woe. I will discuss the matter with Shade.
It is none of your concern, or his, Cress snapped.
I must bid you good night, then,
Woe said with resignation. But as she slipped into her coat to depart, she fixed him with a final disapproving stare.
Look to your faces, Simon Cress, she warned him. Look to your faces.
Puzzled, he wandered back to the tank and stared at the castles after she had taken her departure. His faces were still there as ever.
Except,
he snatched up his magnifying goggles and slipped them on. Even then, it was hard to make out, but it seemed to him that the expression on the face of his images had changed slightly, that his smile was somehow twisted so that it seemed a touch malicious. But it was a very subtle change, if it was a change at all. Cress finally put it down to his suggestibility and resolved not to invite Jala Woe to any more of his gatherings. Over the next few months, Cress and about a dozen of his favorites got together weekly for what he liked to call his war games. Now that his initial fascination with the Sand Kings was past, Cress spent less time around his tank and more on his business affairs and his social life. But he still enjoyed having a few friends over for a war or two. He kept the combatants sharp on a constant edge of hunger. It had severe effects on the Orange Sand Kings, who dwindled visibly until Cress began to wonder if their maw was dead. But the others did well enough. Sometimes at night, when he could not sleep, Cress would take a bottle of wine into the darkened living room, where the red gloom of his miniature desert was the only light. He would drink and watch for hours, alone. There was usually a fight going on somewhere, and when there was not, he could easily start one by dropping in some small morsel of food. They took to betting on the weekly battles, as Mulatta Blaine had suggested. Cress won a good amount by betting on the whites, who had become the most powerful and numerous colony in the tank, with the grandest castle. One week he slid the corner of the tank top aside and dropped the food close to the white castle instead of on the central battleground as usual, so that the others had to attack the whites in their stronghold to get any food at all. They tried. The whites were brilliant in defense. Cress won 100 standards from Jad Rakus. Rakus, in fact, lost heavily on the Sand Kings almost every week. He pretended to a vast knowledge of them and their ways, claiming that he had studied them after the first party. But he had no luck when it came to placing his bets. Cress suspected that Jad's claims were empty boasting. He had tried to study the Sand Kings a bit himself, in a moment of idle curiosity, tying into the library to find out to what world his pets were native. But there was no listing for them. He wanted to get in touch with Wo and ask her about it, but he had other concerns, and the matter kept slipping his mind. Finally, after a month in which his losses totaled more than 1,000 standards, Jad Rackus arrived at the war games carrying a small plastic case under his arm. Inside was a spider-like thing covered with fine golden hair.
"A sand spider," Rackus announced. "From Caffaday. I got it this afternoon from Tetherane the pet seller. Usually they remove the poison sacks, but this one is intact. Are you game, Simon? I want my money back. I'll bet 1,000 standards. Sand spider against sand kings."
Kress studied the spider in its plastic prison. His sand kings had grown. They were twice as large as Woe's, as she'd predicted, but they were still dwarfed by this thing. It was venomed, and they were not. Still, there were an awful lot of them. Besides, the endless Sand King wars had begun to grow tiresome lately. The novelty of the match intrigued him.
"Done," Kress said. "Jad, you are a fool. The Sand Kings will just keep coming until this ugly creature of yours is dead."
"You are the fool, Simon," Rackus replied, smiling. "The Cathedane sand spider customarily feeds on burrowers that hide in nooks and crevices, and, well, watch, it will go straight into those castles and eat the maws."
Kress scowled amid general laughter. He hadn't counted on that.
"Get on with it," he said irritably.
He went to freshen his drink. The spider was too large to cycle conveniently through the food chamber. Two of the others helped Rackus slide the tank top slightly to one side, and Malata Blaine handed him up his case. He shook the spider out. It landed lightly on a miniature dune in front of the Red Castle, and stood confused for a moment, mouth working, legs twitching menacingly.
"Come on," Rackus urged.
They all gathered round the tank. Simon Kress found his magnifiers and slipped them on. If he was going to lose 1,000 standards, at least he wanted a good view of the action. The Sand Kings had seen the invader. All over the castle, activity had ceased. The small scarlet mobiles were frozen, watching. The spider began to move toward the dark promise of the gate. On the tower above, Simon Kress's countenance stared down impassively. At once there was a flurry of activity. The nearest red mobiles formed themselves into two wedges and streamed over the sand toward the spider. More warriors erupted from inside the castle and assembled in a triple line to guard the approach to the underground chamber where the maw lived. Scouts came scuttling over the dunes, recalled to fight. Battle was joined. The attacking Sand Kings washed over the spider. Mandibles snapped shut on legs and abdomen, and clung. Reds raced up the golden legs to the invader's back. They bit and tore. One of them found an eye and ripped it loose with tiny yellow tendrils. Kress smiled and pointed. But they were small, and they had no venom, and the spider did not stop. Its legs flicked Sand Kings off to either side. Its dripping jaws found others, and left them broken and stiffening. Already a dozen of the reds lay dying. The sand spider came on and on. It strode straight through the triple line of guardians before the castle. The lines closed around it, covered it, waging desperate battle. A team of Sand Kings had bitten off one of the spider's legs, Kress saw. Defenders leaped from atop the towers to land on the twitching, heaving mass. Lost beneath the Sand Kings, the spider somehow lurched down into the darkness and vanished. Jad Rackus let out a long breath.
He looked pale.
Wonderful, someone else said. Malata Blaine chuckled deep in her throat.
Look, said Edie Noredian, tugging Cress by the arm. They had been so intent on the struggle in the corner that none of them had noticed the activity elsewhere in the tank. But now the castle was still, the sands empty save for dead red mobiles. And now they saw. Three armies were drawn up before the red castle. They stood quite still, in perfect array, rank after rank of sand kings, orange and white and black, waiting to see what emerged from the depths. Simon Cress smiled.
A cordon sanitaire, he said. And glance at the other castles, if you will, Jad.
Rackus did, and swore. Teams of mobiles were sealing up the gates with sand and stone. If the spider somehow survived this encounter, it would find no easy entrance at the other castles.
I should have brought four spiders, Jad Rackus said. Still, I've won. My spider is down there right now, eating your damned maw.
Cress did not reply. He waited. There was motion in the shadows. All at once, red mobiles began pouring out of the gate. They took their positions on the castle and began repairing the damage the spider had wrought. The other armies dissolved and began to retreat to their respective corners.
Jad, said Simon Cress, I think you are a bit confused about who is eating who. The following week, Rackus brought four slim silver snakes. The Sand Kings dispatched them without much trouble. Next, he tried a large black bird. It ate more than 30 white mobiles, and its thrashing and blundering virtually destroyed their castle, but ultimately its wings grew tired, and the Sand Kings attacked in force wherever it landed. After that, it was a case of insects, armored beetles not too unlike the Sand Kings themselves, but stupid. An allied force of oranges and blacks broke their formation, divided them, and butchered them. Rackus began giving Cress promissory notes. It was around that time that Cress met Cath Mullane again, one evening when he was dining in Asgard at his favorite restaurant. He stopped at her table briefly and told her about the war games, inviting her to join them. She flushed, then regained control of herself and grew icy.
Someone has to put a stop to you, Simon. I guess it's going to be me, she said.
Cress shrugged and enjoyed a lovely meal and thought no more about her threat. Until a week later, when a small, stout woman arrived at his door and showed him a police wristband.
We've had complaints, she said. Do you keep a tank full of dangerous insects, Cress?
Not insects, he said, furious. Come, I'll show you.
When she had seen the Sand Kings, she shook her head.
This will never do. What do you know about these creatures, anyway? Do you know what world they're from? Have they been cleared by the Ecological Board? Do you have a license for these things?
We have a report that they're carnivores, possibly dangerous. We also have a report that they are semi-sentient. Where did you get these creatures, anyway?
From Woe and Shade, Cress replied.
Never heard of them, the woman said. Probably smuggled them in, knowing our ecologists would never approve them. No, Cress, this won't do. I'm going to confiscate this tank and have it destroyed, and you're going to have to expect a few fines as well.
Cress offered her 100 standards to forget all about him and his Sand Kings. She tsked.
Now I'll have to add attempted bribery to the charges against you.
Not until he raised the figure to 2,000 standards was she willing to be persuaded.
"It's not going to be easy, you know," she said. "There are forms to be altered, records to be wiped, and getting a forged license from the ecologists will be time-consuming, not to mention dealing with a complainant. What if she calls again?"
"Leave her to me," Cress said. "Leave her to me." He thought about it for a while. That night, he made some calls. First, he got Tetherane the pet seller. "I want to buy a dog," he said. "A puppy." The round-faced merchant gawked at him.
"A puppy? That is not like you, Simon.
Why don't you come in? I have a lovely choice."
"I want a very specific kind of puppy," Cress said. "Take notes. I'll describe to you what it must look like."
Afterward, he punched for Edie Noredian.
"Edie," he said, "I want you out here tonight with your hollow equipment. I have a notion to record a Sand King battle, a present for one of my friends."
The night after they made the recording, Simon Cress stayed up late. He absorbed a controversial new drama in his sensorium, fixed himself a small snack, smoked a joystick or two, and broke out a bottle of wine. Feeling very happy with himself, he wandered into the living room, glass in hand. The lights were out. The red glow of the terrarium made the shadows flushed and feverish. He walked over to look at his domain, curious as to how the blacks were doing in the repairs on their castle. The puppy had left it in ruins. The restoration went well, but as Cress inspected the work through his magnifiers, he chanced to glance closely at the face. It startled him. He drew back, blinked, took a healthy gulp of wine, and looked again. The face on the wall was still his, but it was all wrong, all twisted. His cheeks were bloated and piggish. His smile was a crooked leer. He looked impossibly malevolent. Uneasy, he moved around the tank to inspect the other castles. They were each a bit different, but ultimately all the same. The oranges had left out most of the fine detail, but the result still seemed monstrous, crude, a brutal mouth and mindless eyes. The reds gave him a satanic, twitching kind of smile. His mouth did odd, unlovely things at its corners. The whites, his favorites, had carved a cruel idiot god. Simon Cress flung his wine across the room in rage. "You dare," he said under his breath. "Now you won't eat for a week, you damned—" His voice was shrill. "I'll teach you." He had an idea. He strode out of the room and returned a moment later with an antique iron throwing sword in his hand. It was a meter long, and the point was still sharp. Cress smiled, climbed up, and moved the tank cover aside just enough to give him working room, opening one corner of the desert. He leaned down and jabbed the sword at the white castle below him. He waved it back and forth, smashing towers and ramparts and walls. Sand and stone collapsed, burying the scrambling mobiles. A flick of his wrist obliterated the features of the insolent, insulting caricature the Sand Kings had made of his face. Then he poised the point of the sword above the dark mouth that opened down into the maw's chamber, and thrust with all his strength. He heard a soft, squishing sound, and met resistance. All of the mobiles trembled and collapsed. Satisfied, Cress pulled back. He watched for a moment, wondering whether he'd killed the maw. The point of the throwing sword was wet and slimy. But finally, The White Sand Kings began to move again, feebly, slowly, but they moved. He was preparing to slide the cover back in place and move on to a second castle when he felt something crawling on his hand. He screamed and dropped the sword and brushed the Sand King from his flesh. It fell to the carpet, and he ground it beneath his heel, crushing it thoroughly long after it was dead. It had crunched when he stepped on it. After that, trembling, he hurried to seal the tank up again and rushed off to shower and inspect himself carefully. He boiled his clothing. Later, after several fresh glasses of wine, he returned to the living room. He was a bit ashamed of the way the Sand King had terrified him, but he was not about to open the tank again. From now on, the cover stayed sealed permanently. Still, he had to punish the others. Kress decided to lubricate his mental processes with another glass of wine. As he finished it, an inspiration came to him. He went to the tank, smiling, and made a few adjustments to the humidity controls. By the time he fell asleep on the couch, his wine glass still in his hand, the sandcastles were melting in the rain. Kress woke to angry pounding on his door. He sat up groggy, his head throbbing. Wine hangovers were always the worst, he thought. He lurched to the entry chamber. Kath Mullane was outside.
"You monster," she said,
her face swollen and puffy and streaked by tears.
"I cried all night, damn you. But no more, Simon. No more."
"Easy," he said, holding his head. "I've got a hangover." She swore and shoved him aside and pushed her way into his house. The shambler came peering round a corner to see what the noise was. She spat at it and stalked into the living room, Kress trailing ineffectually after her.
"Hold on," he said. "Where do you... You can't..."
He stopped, suddenly horror-struck. She was carrying a heavy sledgehammer in her left hand. "No," he said. She went directly to the Sand King tank.
"You like the little charmers so much, Simon? Then you can live with them."
"Kath!"
he shrieked. Gripping the hammer with both hands, she swung as hard as she could against the side of the tank. The sound of the impact set his head to screaming, and Kress made a low, blubbering sound of despair. But the plastic held. She swung again. This time there was a crack, and a network of thin lines sprang into being. Kress threw himself at her as she drew back her hammer for a third swing. They went down, flailing, and rolled. She lost her grip on the hammer and tried to throttle him, but Kress wrenched free and bit her on the arm, drawing blood. They both staggered to their feet, panting.
"You should see yourself, Simon," she said grimly. "Blood dripping from your mouth. You look like one of your pets. How do you like the taste?"
"Get out," he said.
He saw the throwing sword where it had fallen the night before and snatched it up.
"Get out," he repeated,
waving the sword for emphasis.
"Don't go near that tank again."
She laughed at him.
"You wouldn't dare," she said.
She bent to pick up her hammer. Kress shrieked at her and lunged. Before he quite knew what was happening, the iron blade had gone clear through her abdomen. Kath Mullane looked at him wonderingly, and down at the sword. Kress fell back, whimpering.
"I didn't mean... I only wanted..."
She was transfixed, bleeding, dead. But somehow she did not fall.
"You monster," she managed to say, though her mouth was full of blood, and she whirled impossibly, the sword in her, and swung with her last strength at the tank. The tortured wall shattered, and Cath Mullane was buried beneath an avalanche of plastic and sand and mud. Cress made small hysterical noises and scrambled up on the couch. Sand kings were emerging from the muck on his living room floor. They were crawling across Cath's body. A few of them ventured tentatively out across the carpet. More followed. He watched as a column took shape, a living, writhing square of sand kings, bearing something, something slimy and featureless, a piece of raw meat big as a man's head. They began to carry it away from the tank. It pulsed. That was when Cress broke and ran. It was late afternoon before he found the courage to return. He had run to his skimmer and flown to the nearest city, some 50 kilometers away, almost sick with fear. But once safely away, he had found a small restaurant, put down several mugs of coffee and 2 anti-hangover tabs, eaten a full breakfast, and gradually regained his composure. It had been a dreadful morning, but dwelling on that would solve nothing. He ordered more coffee and considered his situation with icy rationality. Cath Mullane was dead at his hand. Could he report it? Plead that it had been an accident? Unlikely. He had run her through, after all, and he had already told that policer to leave her to him. He would have to get rid of the evidence and hope that she had not told anyone where she was going this morning. That was probable. She could only have gotten his gift late last night. She said that she had cried all night, and she had been alone when she arrived. Very well. He had one body and one skimmer to dispose of. That left the Sand Kings. They might prove more of a difficulty. No doubt they had all escaped by now. The thought of them around his house, in his bed and his clothes, infesting his food, it made his flesh crawl. He shuddered and overcame his revulsion. It really shouldn't be too hard to kill them, he reminded himself. He didn't have to account for every mobile, just the 4 maws, that was all. He could do that. They were large, as he'd seen. He would find them and kill them. Simon Cress went shopping before he flew back to his home. He bought a set of skin thins that would cover him from head to foot, several bags of poison pellets for rock jock control, and a spray canister of illegally strong pesticide. He also bought a Magnalock towing device. When he landed, he went about things methodically. First, he hooked Cath's skimmer to his own with the Magnalock. Searching it, he had his first piece of luck. The crystal chip with Edie Noredian's hollow of the Sand King fight was on the front seat. He had worried about that. When the skimmers were ready, he slipped into his skin thins and went inside for Cath's body. It wasn't there. He poked through the fast-drying sand carefully, but there was no doubt of it. The body was gone. Could she have dragged herself away? Unlikely, but Cress searched. A cursory inspection of his house turned up neither the body nor any sign of the Sand Kings. He did not have time for a more thorough investigation, not with the incriminating skimmer outside his front door. He resolved to try later. Some 70 kilometers north of Cress's estate was a range of active volcanoes. He flew there, Cath's skimmer in tow. Above the glowering cone of the largest, he released the Magnalock and watched it vanish in the lava below. It was dusk when he returned to his house.
That gave him pause. Briefly, he considered flying back to the city and spending the night there. He put the thought aside. There was work to do. He wasn't safe yet. He scattered the poison pellets around the exterior of his house. No one would find that suspicious. He'd always had a rock chalk problem. When that task was completed, he primed the canister of pesticide and ventured back inside. Kress went through the house room by room, turning on lights everywhere he went until he was surrounded by a blaze of artificial illumination. He paused to clean up in the living room, shoveling sand and plastic fragments back into the broken tank. The Sand Kings were all gone, as he'd feared. The castles were shrunken and distorted, slagged by the watery bombardment Kress had visited upon them, and what little remained was crumbling as it dried. He frowned and searched on, the canister of pest spray strapped across his shoulders. Down in his deepest wine cellar, he came upon Calf Malane's corpse. It sprawled at the foot of a steep flight of stairs, the limbs twisted as if by a fall. White mobiles were swarming all over it, and as Kress watched, the body moved jerkily across the hard-packed dirt floor. He laughed and twisted the illumination up to maximum. In the far corner, a squat little earthen castle and a dark hole were visible between two wine racks. Kress could make out a rough outline of his face on the cellar wall. The body shifted once again, moving a few centimeters toward the castle. Kress had a sudden vision of the white maw waiting hungrily. It might be able to get Kath's foot in its mouth, but no more. It was too absurd. He laughed again and started down into the cellar, finger poised on the trigger of the hose that snaked down his right arm. The Sand Kings, hundreds of them, moving as one, deserted the body and formed up battle lines, a field of white between him and their maw. Suddenly, Kress had another inspiration. He smiled and lowered his firing hand. "Kath was always hard to swallow," he said, delighted at his wit. "Especially for one your size. Here, let me give you some help. What are gods for, after all?" He retreated upstairs, returning shortly with a cleaver. The Sand Kings, patient, waited and watched while Kress chopped Calf Malane into small, easily digestible pieces. Simon Kress slept in his skin-thins that night, the pesticide close at hand. But he did not need it. The whites, sated, remained in the cellar, and he saw no sign of the others. In the morning, he finished the cleanup of the living room. After he was through, no trace of the struggle remained, except for the broken tank. He ate a light lunch and resumed his hunt for the missing Sand Kings. In full daylight, it was not too difficult. The blacks had located in his rock garden and built a castle heavy with obsidian and quartz. The reds he found at the bottom of his long disused swimming pool, which had partially filled with wind-blown sand over the years. He saw mobiles of both colors ranging about his grounds, many of them carrying poison pellets back to their maws. Kress decided his pesticide was unnecessary. No use risking a fight when he could just let the poison do its work. Both maws should be dead by evening. That left only the burnt orange Sand Kings unaccounted for. Kress circled his estate several times, in ever-widening spirals, but found no trace of them. When he began to sweat in his skin thins, it was a hot, dry day, he decided it was not important. If they were out here, they were probably eating the poison pellets along with the reds and blacks. He crunched several Sand Kings underfoot,
with a certain degree of satisfaction as he walked back to the house. Inside, he removed his skin thins, settled down to a delicious meal, and finally began to relax. Everything was under control. Two of the maws would soon be defunct. The third was safely located where he could dispose of it after it had served his purposes, and he had no doubt that he would find the fourth. As for Kath, all trace of her visit had been obliterated. His reverie was interrupted when his view screen began to blink at him. It was Jad Rackus, calling to brag about some cannibal worms he was bringing to the war games tonight. Kress had forgotten about that, but he recovered quickly. "Oh, Jad, my pardons. I neglected to tell you. I grew bored with all that and got rid of the Sand Kings. Ugly little things. Sorry, but there'll be no party tonight." Rackus was indignant.
"But what will I do with my worms?"
"Put them in a basket of fruit and send them to a loved one," Kress said, signing off. Quickly, he began calling the others. He did not need anyone arriving at his doorstep now, with the Sand Kings alive and infesting the estate. As he was calling Edie Noredian, Kress became aware of an annoying oversight. The screen began to clear, indicating that someone had answered at the other end. Kress flicked off. Edie arrived on schedule an hour later. She was surprised to find the party canceled, but perfectly happy to share an evening alone with Kress. He delighted her with his story of Kath's reaction to the hollow they had made together. While telling it, he managed to ascertain that she had not mentioned the prank to anyone. He nodded, satisfied, and refilled their wine glasses. Only a trickle was left.
"I'll have to get a fresh bottle," he said.
"Come with me to my wine cellar and help me pick out a good vintage. You've always had a better palate than I." She came along willingly enough, but balked at the top of the stairs when Kress opened the door and gestured for her to precede him.
"Where are the lights?" she said. "And that smell. What's that peculiar smell, Simon?"
When he shoved her, she looked briefly startled. She screamed as she tumbled down the stairs. Kress closed the door and began to nail it shut with the boards and air hammer he had left for that purpose. As he was finishing, he heard Edie groan.
"I'm hurt," she said. "Simon, what is this?"
Suddenly she squealed. And shortly after that, the screaming started. It did not cease for hours. Kress went to his sensorium and dialed up a saucy comedy to blot it off his mind. When he was sure she was dead, Kress flew her skimmer north to the volcanoes and discarded it. The Magnalock was proving a good investment. Odd scrabbling noises were coming from beyond the wine cellar door the next morning when Kress went down to check it out. He listened for several uneasy moments, wondering if Edie Noredian could possibly have survived and was now scratching to get out. It seemed unlikely. It had to be the Sand Kings. Kress did not like the implications of that. He decided that he would keep the door sealed, at least for the moment, and went outside with a shovel to bury the red and black maws in their own castles. He found them very much alive. The black castle was glittering with volcanic glass, and Sand Kings were all over it, repairing and improving. The highest tower was up to his waist, and on it was a hideous caricature of his face. When he approached, the blacks halted in their labors and formed up into two threatening phalanxes. Kress glanced behind him and saw others closing off his escape. Startled, he dropped the shovel and sprinted out of the trap, crushing several mobiles beneath his boots. The red castle was creeping up the walls of the swimming pool. The mall was safely settled in a pit, surrounded by sand and concrete and battlements. The reds crept all over the bottom of the pool. Kress watched them carry a rock jock and a large lizard into the castle. He stepped back from the poolside, horrified, and felt something crunch. Looking down, he saw three mobiles climbing up his leg. He brushed them off and stamped them to death, but others were approaching quickly. They were larger than he remembered. Some were almost as big as his thumb. He ran. By the time he reached the safety of the house, his heart was racing, and he was short of breath. The door closed behind him, and Kress hurried to lock it. His house was supposed to be pest-proof. He'd be safe in here. A stiff drink steadied his nerve. So poison doesn't faze them, he thought. He should have known. Woe had warned him that the maw could eat anything. He would have to use the pesticide. Kress took another drink for good measure, donned his skin thins, and strapped the canister to his back. He unlocked the door. Outside, the Sand Kings were waiting. Two armies confronted him, allied against the common threat, more than he could have guessed. The damned maws must be breeding like rock jocks. They were everywhere, a creeping sea of them. Kress brought up the hose and flicked the trigger. A gray mist washed over the nearest rank of Sand Kings. He moved his hand from side to side. Where the mist fell, the Sand Kings twitched violently and died in sudden spasms. Kress smiled. They were no match for him. He sprayed in a wide arc before him and stepped forward confidently over a litter of black and red bodies. The armies fell back. Kress advanced, intent on cutting through them to their maws. All at once, the retreat stopped. 1,000 Sand Kings surged toward him. Kress had been expecting the counterattack. He stood his ground, sweeping his misty sword before him in great looping strokes. They came at him and died. A few got through. He could not spray everywhere at once. He felt them climbing up his legs, sensed their mandibles biting futilely at the reinforced plastic of his skin thins. He ignored them and kept spraying. Then he began to feel soft impacts on his head and shoulders. Kress trembled and spun and looked up above him. The front of his house was alive with Sand Kings, blacks and reds, hundreds of them. They were launching themselves into the air, raining down on him. They fell all around him. One landed on his faceplate, its mandibles scraping at his eyes for a terrible second before he plucked it away. He swung up his hose and sprayed the air, sprayed the house, sprayed until the airborne Sand Kings were all dead and dying. The mist settled back on him, making him cough. He coughed and kept spraying. Only when the front of the house was clean did Kress turn his attention back to the ground. They were all around him, on him, dozens of them scurrying over his body, hundreds of others hurrying to join them. He turned the mist on them. The hose went dead. Kress heard a loud hiss, and the deadly fog rose in a great cloud from between his shoulders, cloaking him, choking him, making his eyes burn and blur. He felt for the hose, and his hand came away covered with dying Sand Kings. The hose was severed. They'd eaten it through. He was surrounded by a shroud of pesticide, blinded. He stumbled and screamed and began to run back to the house, pulling Sand Kings from his body as he went. Inside, he sealed the door and collapsed on the carpet, rolling back and forth until he was sure he had crushed them all. The canister was empty by then, hissing feebly. Kress stripped off his skin thins and showered. The hot spray scalded him and left his skin reddened and sensitive, but it made his flesh stop crawling. He dressed in his heaviest clothing, thick work pants and leathers, after shaking them out nervously.
Damn,
he kept muttering.
Damn.
His throat was dry. After searching the entry hall thoroughly, to make certain it was clean, he allowed himself to sit and pour a drink.
Damn,
he repeated. His hand shook as he poured, slopping liquor on the carpet. The alcohol settled him, but it did not wash away the fear. He had a second drink and went to the window furtively. Sand kings were moving across the thick plastic pane. He shuddered and retreated to his communications console. He had to get help, he thought wildly. He would punch through a call to the authorities, and policers would come out with flamethrowers and... Simon Kress stopped in mid-call and groaned. He couldn't call in the police. He would have to tell them about the whites in his cellar, and they'd find the bodies there. Perhaps the Maw might have finished Kath Mullane by now, but certainly not Edie Noreddian. He hadn't even cut her up. Besides, there would be bones. No, the police could be called in only as a last resort. He sat at the console, frowning. His communications equipment filled a whole wall. From here, he could reach anyone on Baldur. He had plenty of money. And his cunning. He had always prided himself on his cunning. He would handle this somehow. He briefly considered calling Wo, but soon dismissed the idea. Wo knew too much, and she would ask questions, and he did not trust her. No, he needed someone who would do as he asked without questions. His frown faded and slowly turned into a smile. Simon Kress had contacts. He put through a call to a number he had not used in a long time. A woman's face took shape on his viewscreen, white-haired, bland of expression, with a long hook nose. Her voice was brisk and efficient. "Simon," she said, "how is business?"
"Business is fine, Lysandra," Kress replied. "I have a job for you."
"A removal? My price has gone up since last time, Simon. It has been 10 years, after all."
"You will be well paid," Kress said. "You know I'm generous. I want you for a bit of pest control." She smiled a thin smile.
"No need to use euphemisms, Simon. The call is shielded."
"No, I'm serious. I have a pest problem, dangerous pests. Take care of them for me. No questions. Understood?"
"Understood."
"Good. You'll need, oh, 3 or 4 operatives. Wear heat-resistant skin thins and equip them with flamethrowers or lasers. Something on that order. Come out to my place. You'll see the problem. Bugs. Lots and lots of them. In my rock garden and the old swimming pool, you'll find castles. Destroy them. Kill everything inside them. Then knock on the door, and I'll show you what else needs to be done. Can you get out here quickly?" Her face was impassive.
"We'll leave within the hour."
Lysandra was true to her word. She arrived in a lean black skimmer with 3 operatives. Kress watched them from the safety of a second-story window. They were all faceless in dark plastic skin thins. 2 of them wore portable flamethrowers. 1/3 carried a laser cannon and explosives. Lysandra carried nothing. Kress recognized her by the way she gave orders. Their skimmer passed low overhead first, checking out the situation. The Sand Kings went mad. Scarlet and Ebon mobiles ran everywhere, frenetic. Kress could see the castle in the rock garden from his vantage point. It stood tall as a man. Its ramparts were crawling with black defenders, and a steady stream of mobiles flowed down into its depths. Lysandra's skimmer came down next to Cress's, and the operatives vaulted out and unlimbered their weapons. They looked inhuman, deadly. The Black Army drew up between them and the castle. The Reds. Cress suddenly realized that he could not see the Reds. He blinked. Where had they gone? Lysandra pointed and shouted, and her two flamethrowers spread out and opened up on the Black Sand Kings. Their weapons coughed dully and began to roar, long tongues of blue and scarlet fire licking out before them. Sand Kings crisped and blackened and died. The operatives began to play the fire back and forth in an efficient interlocking pattern. They advanced with careful, measured steps. The Black Army burned and disintegrated, the mobiles fleeing in 1,000 different directions, some back toward the castle, others toward the enemy. None reached the operatives with the flamethrowers. Lysandra's people were very professional. Then one of them stumbled, or seemed to stumble. Cress looked again and saw that the ground had given way beneath the man. Tunnels, he thought with a tremor of fear. Tunnels, pits, traps. The flamer was sunk in sand up to his waist, and suddenly the ground around him seemed to erupt, and he was covered with scarlet sand kings. He dropped the flamethrower and began to claw wildly at his own body. His screams were horrible to hear. His companion hesitated, then swung and fired. A blast of flame swallowed human and sand kings both. The screaming stopped abruptly. Satisfied, the second flamer turned back to the castle and took another step forward, and recoiled as his foot broke through the ground and vanished up to the ankle. He tried to pull it back and retreat, and the sand all around him gave way. He lost his balance and stumbled, flailing, and the Sand Kings were everywhere, a boiling mass of them, covering him as he writhed and rolled. His flamethrower was useless and forgotten. Cress pounded wildly on the window, shouting for attention. The castle! Get the castle! Lysandra, standing back by her skimmer, heard and gestured. Her third operative sighted with the laser cannon and fired. The beam throbbed across the grounds and sliced off the top of the castle. He brought it down sharply, hacking at the sand and stone parapets. Towers fell. Cress's face disintegrated. The laser bit into the ground, searching round and about. The castle crumbled. Now it was only a heap of sand, but the black mobiles continued to move. The maw was buried too deeply. They hadn't touched her. Lysandra gave another order. Her operative discarded the laser, primed an explosive, and darted forward. He leaped over the smoking corpse of the first flamer, landed on solid ground within Cress's rock garden, and heaved. The explosive ball landed square atop the ruins of the Black Castle. White-hot light seared Cress's eyes, and there was a tremendous gout of sand and rock and mobiles. For a moment, dust obscured everything. It was raining Sand Kings and pieces of Sand Kings. Cress saw that the black mobiles were dead and unmoving. The pool! He shouted down through the window. Get the castle in the pool! Lysandra understood quickly. The ground was littered with motionless blacks, but the Reds were pulling back hurriedly and reforming. Her operative stood uncertain, then reached down and pulled out another explosive ball. He took one step forward, but Lysandra called him, and he sprinted back in her direction. It was all so simple then. He reached the skimmer, and Lysandra took him aloft. Cress rushed to another window in another room to watch. They came swooping in just over the pool, and the operative pitched his bombs down at the Red Castle from the safety of the skimmer. After the fourth run, The castle was unrecognizable, and the Sand Kings stopped moving. Lysandra was thorough. She had him bomb each castle several additional times. Then he used the laser cannon, crisscrossing methodically until it was certain that nothing living could remain intact beneath those small patches of ground. Finally, they came knocking at his door. Kress was grinning maniacally when he let them in.
"Lovely," he said. "Lovely."
Lysandra pulled off the mask of her skin thins.
"This will cost you, Simon. 2 operatives gone, not to mention the danger to my own life."
"Of course," Kress blurted. "You'll be well paid, Lysandra. Whatever you ask, just so you finish the job."
"What remains to be done?"
"You have to clean out my wine cellar," Kress said. "There's another castle down there. And you'll have to do it without explosives. I don't want my house coming down around me."
Lysandra motioned to her operative. "Go outside and get Reich's flamethrower. It should be intact."
He returned armed, ready, silent. Kress led them down to the wine cellar. The heavy door was still nailed shut as he had left it, but it bulged outward slightly, as if warped by some tremendous pressure. That made Kress uneasy, as did the silence that held reign about them. He stood well away from the door as Lysandra's operative removed his nails and planks. "Is that safe in here?" he found himself muttering, pointing at the flamethrower. "I don't want a fire either, you know."
"I have the laser," Lysandra said. "We'll use that for the kill. The flamethrower probably won't be needed, but I want it here just in case. There are worse things than fire, Simon."
He nodded. The last plank came free of the cellar door. There was still no sound from below. Lysandra snapped an order, and her underling fell back, took up a position behind her, and leveled the flamethrower square at the door. She slipped her mask back on, hefted the laser, stepped forward, and pulled open the door. No motion. No sound. It was dark down there.
"Is there a light?"
Lysandra asked. "Just inside the door," Kress said. "On the right-hand side. Mind the stairs, they're quite steep." She stepped into the door, shifted the laser to her left hand, and reached up with her right, fumbling inside for the light panel. Nothing happened.
"I feel it," Lysandra said, "but it doesn't seem to..."
Then she was screaming, and she stumbled backward. A great white Sand King had clamped itself around her wrist. Blood welled through her skin thins where its mandibles had sunk in. It was fully as large as her hand. Lysandra did a horrible little jig across the room and began to smash her hand against the nearest wall. Again and again and again. It landed with a heavy, meaty thud. Finally, the Sand King fell away. She whimpered and fell to her knees.
"I think my fingers are broken," she said softly.
The blood was still flowing freely. She had dropped the laser near the cellar door.
"I'm not going down there," her operative announced in clear, firm tones.
Lysandra looked up at him.
"No," she said. "Stand in the door and flame it all. Cinder it. Do you understand?"
He nodded. Simon Kress moaned.
"My house," he said.
His stomach churned. The White Sand King had been so large. How many more were down there?
"Don't," he continued. "Leave it alone. I've changed my mind. Leave it alone."
Lysandra misunderstood. She held out her hand. It was covered with blood and greenish-black ichor.
"Your little friend bit clean through my glove, and you saw what it took to get it off. I don't care about your house, Simon. Whatever is down there is going to die.
Kress hardly heard her. He thought he could see movement in the shadows beyond the cellar door. He imagined a white army bursting forth, all as large as the Sand King that had attacked Lysandra. He saw himself being lifted by 100 tiny arms and dragged down into the darkness where the maw waited hungrily. He was afraid. "Don't," he said. They ignored him. Kress darted forward, and his shoulder slammed into the back of Lysandra's operative just as the man was bracing to fire. He grunted and unbalanced and pitched forward into the black. Kress listened to him fall down the stairs. Afterward, there were other noises, scuttlings and snaps, and soft, squishing sounds. Kress swung around to face Lysandra. He was drenched in cold sweat, but a sickly kind of excitement was on him. It was almost sexual. Lysandra's calm, cold eyes regarded him through her mask.
"What are you doing?" she demanded,
as Kress picked up the laser she had dropped.
"Simon!"
"Making a peace," he said, giggling. "They won't hurt God. No, not so long as God is good and generous. I was cruel, starved them. I have to make up for it now, you see."
"You're insane,"
Lysandra said. It was the last thing she said. Kress burned a hole in her chest big enough to put his arm through. He dragged the body across the floor and rolled it down the cellar stairs. The noises were louder, chitinous clackings and scrapings and echoes that were thick and liquid. Kress nailed up the door once again. As he fled, he was filled with a deep sense of contentment that coated his fear like a layer of syrup. He suspected it was not his own. He planned to leave his home, to fly to the city and take a room for a night, or perhaps for a year. Instead, Kress started drinking. He was not quite sure why. He drank steadily for hours and retched it all up violently on his living room carpet. At some point, he fell asleep. When he woke, it was pitch dark in the house. He cowered against the couch. He could hear noises. Things were moving in the walls. They were around him. His hearing was extraordinarily acute. Every little creak was the footstep of a Sand King. He closed his eyes and waited, expecting to feel their terrible touch, afraid to move lest he brush against one. Kress sobbed and was very still for a while. But nothing happened. He opened his eyes again. He trembled. Slowly the shadows began to soften and dissolve. Moonlight was filtering through the high windows. His eyes adjusted. The living room was empty. Nothing there, nothing. Nothing. Only his drunken fears. Simon Kress steeled himself and rose and went to a light. Nothing there. The room was quiet, deserted. He listened. Nothing. No sound. Nothing in the walls. It had all been his imagination. His fear. The memories of Lysandra and the thing in the cellar returned to him unbidden. Shame and anger washed over him. Why had he done that? He could have helped her burn it out, kill it. Why? He knew why. The maw had done it to him, put fear in him. Woe had said it was psionic, even when it was small. And now it was large, so large. It had feasted on Kath and Edie, and now it had two more bodies down there.
it would keep growing. And it had learned to like the taste of human flesh, he thought. He began to shake, but he took control of himself again and stopped. It wouldn't hurt him. He was God. The whites had always been his favorites. He remembered how he had stabbed it with his throwing sword. That was before Kath came. Damn her anyway. He couldn't stay here. The maw would grow hungry again. Large as it was, it wouldn't take long. Its appetite would be terrible. What would it do then? He had to get away, back to the safety of the city, while it was still contained in his wine cellar. It was only plaster and hard-packed earth down there, and the mobiles could dig and tunnel. When they got free, Kress didn't want to think about it. He went to his bedroom and packed. He took 3 bags, just a single change of clothing. That was all he needed. The rest of the space he filled with his valuables, with jewelry and art and other things he could not bear to lose. He did not expect to return. His shambler followed him down the stairs, staring at him from its baleful, glowing eyes. It was gaunt. Kress realized that it had been ages since he had fed it. Normally it could take care of itself, but no doubt the pickings had grown lean of late. When it tried to clutch at his leg, he snarled at it and kicked it away, and it scurried off, offended. Kress slipped outside, carrying his bags awkwardly, and shut the door behind him. For a moment, he stood pressed against the house, his heart thudding in his chest. Only a few meters between him and his skimmer. He was afraid to cross them. The moonlight was bright, and the front of his house was a scene of carnage. The bodies of Lysandra's 2 flamers lay where they had fallen, one twisted and burned, the other swollen beneath a mass of dead sand kings. And the mobiles, the black and red mobiles, they were all around him. It was an effort to remember that they were dead. It was almost as if they were simply waiting, as they had waited so often before. Nonsense, Kress told himself, more drunken fears. He had seen the castles blown apart. They were dead, and the white maw was trapped in his cellar. He took several deep and deliberate breaths and stepped forward onto the Sand Kings. They crunched. He ground them into the sand savagely. They did not move. Kress smiled and walked slowly across the battleground, listening to the sounds. The sounds of safety. Crunch. Crackle. Crunch. He lowered his bags to the ground and opened the door to his skimmer. Something moved from shadow into light. A pale shape on the seat of his skimmer. It was as long as his forearm. Its mandibles clacked together softly, and it looked up at him from 6 small eyes set all around its body. Kress wet his pants and backed away slowly. There was more motion from inside the skimmer. He had left the door open. The Sand King emerged and came toward him cautiously. Others followed. They had been hiding beneath his seats, burrowed into the upholstery. But now they emerged. They formed a ragged ring around the skimmer. Kress licked his lips, turned, and moved quickly to Lysandra's skimmer. He stopped before he was halfway there. Things were moving inside that one, too, great maggoty things, half seen by the light of the moon. Kress whimpered and retreated back toward the house. Near the front door, he looked up. He counted 12 long white shapes creeping back and forth across the walls of the building. 4 of them were clustered close together near the top of the unused belfry where the carrion hawk had once roosted. They were carving something. A face. A very recognizable face.
Simon Kress shrieked and ran back inside. A sufficient quantity of drink brought him the easy oblivion he sought. But he woke. Despite everything, he woke. He had a terrible headache, and he smelled, and he was hungry. Oh, so very hungry. He had never been so hungry. Kress knew it was not his own stomach hurting. A white sand king watched him from atop the dresser in his bedroom, its antennae moving faintly. It was as big as the one in the skimmer the night before. He was horribly dry, sandpaper dry. He licked his lips and fled from the room. The house was full of sand kings. He had to be careful where he put his feet. They all seemed busy on errands of their own. They were making modifications in his house, burrowing into or out of his walls, carving things. Twice he saw his own likeness staring out at him from unexpected places. The faces were warped, twisted, livid with fear. He went outside to get the bodies that had been rotting in the yard, hoping to appease the white maw's hunger. They were gone, both of them. Kress remembered how easily the mobiles could carry things many times their own weight. It was terrible to think that the maw was still hungry after all of that. When Kress re-entered the house, a column of sand kings was wending its way down the stairs. Each carried a piece of his shambler. The head seemed to look at him reproachfully as it went by. Kress emptied his freezers, his cabinets, everything, piling all the food in the house in the center of his kitchen floor. A dozen whites waited to take it away. They avoided the frozen food, leaving it to thaw in a great puddle, but they carried off everything else. When all the food was gone, Kress felt his own hunger pangs abate just a bit, though he had not eaten a thing. But he knew the respite would be short-lived. Soon the maw would be hungry again. He had to feed it. Kress knew what to do. He went to his communicator. "Malada," he began casually when the first of his friends answered. "I'm having a small party tonight. I realize this is terribly short notice, but I hope you can make it. I really do." He called Jad Rackus next, and then the others. By the time he had finished, 9 of them had accepted his invitation. Kress hoped that would be enough. Kress met his guests outside. The mobiles had cleaned up remarkably quickly, and the grounds looked almost as they had before the battle, and walked them to his front door. He let them enter first. He did not follow. When 4 of them had gone through, Kress finally worked up his courage. He closed the door behind his latest guest, ignoring the startled exclamations that soon turned into shrill gibbering, and sprinted for the skimmer the man had arrived in. He slid in safely, thumbed the start plate, and swore. It was programmed to lift only in response to its owner's thumbprint. Of course. Jad Rackus was the next to arrive. Kress ran to his skimmer as it sat down and seized Rackus by the arm as he was climbing out. "Get back in, quickly," he said, pushing. "Take me to the city." "Hurry, Jad. Get out of here." But Rackus only stared at him and would not move.
"Why? What's wrong, Simon? I don't understand. What about your party?"
And then it was too late, because the loose sand all around them was stirring, and the red eyes were staring at them, and the mandibles were clacking. Rackus made a choking sound and moved to get back in his skimmer, but a pair of mandibles snapped shut about his ankle, and suddenly he was on his knees. The sand seemed to boil with subterranean activity. Jad thrashed and cried terribly as they tore him apart. Kress could hardly bear to watch. After that, he did not try to escape again. When it was all over, he cleaned out what remained in his liquor cabinet and got extremely drunk. It would be the last time he would enjoy that luxury, he knew. The only alcohol remaining in the house was stored down in the wine cellar. Kress did not touch a bite of food the entire day, but he fell asleep feeling bloated, sated at last, the awful hunger vanquished. His last thoughts, before the nightmares took him, were of whom he could ask out tomorrow. Morning was hot and dry. Kress opened his eyes to see the white Sand King on his dresser again. He shut them again quickly, hoping the dream would leave him. It did not, and he could not go back to sleep. Soon he found himself staring at the thing. He stared for almost 5 minutes before the strangeness of it dawned on him. The Sand King was not moving. The mobiles could be preternaturally still, to be sure. He had seen them wait and watch 1,000 times, but always there was some motion about them. The mandibles clacked, the legs twitched, the long, fine antennae stirred and swayed. But the Sand King on his dresser was completely still. Kress rose, holding his breath, not daring to hope. Could it be dead? Could something have killed it? He walked across the room. The eyes were glassy and black. The creature seemed swollen somehow, as if it were soft and rotting inside, filling up with gas that pushed outward at the plates of white armor. Kress reached out a trembling hand and touched it. It was warm, hot even, and growing hotter. But it did not move. He pulled his hand back, and as he did, a segment of the Sand King's white exoskeleton fell away from it. The flesh beneath was the same color, but softer looking, swollen and feverish, and it almost seemed to throb. Kress backed away and ran to the door. 3 more white mobiles lay in his hall. They were all like the one in his bedroom. He ran down the stairs, jumping over Sand Kings. None of them moved. The house was full of them. All dead, dying, comatose, whatever. Kress did not care what was wrong with them, just so they could not move. He found 4 of them inside his skimmer. He picked them up one by one and threw them as far as he could. Damned monsters. He slid back in on the ruined half-eaten seats and thumbed the start plate. Nothing happened. Kress tried again. And again. Nothing. It wasn't fair. This was his skimmer. It ought to start. Why wouldn't it lift? He didn't understand. Finally, he got out and checked, expecting the worst. He found it. The Sand Kings had torn apart his gravity grid. He was trapped. He was still trapped. Grimly, Kress marched back into the house. He went to his gallery and found the antique axe that had hung next to the throwing sword he had used on Cath Mullane. He set to work. The Sand Kings did not stir, even as he chopped them to pieces. But they splattered when he made the first cut, the bodies almost bursting. Inside was awful. Strange, half-formed organs, a viscous, reddish ooze that looked almost like human blood, and the yellow ichor. Kress destroyed 20 of them before he realized the futility of what he was doing. The mobiles were nothing, really. Besides, there were so many of them. He could work for a day and night and still not kill them all. He had to go down into the wine cellar and use the axe on the maw. Resolute, he started down. He got within sight of the door and stopped. It was not a door anymore. The walls had been eaten away, so that the hole was twice the size it had been. And round. A pit. That was all. There was no sign that there had ever been a door nailed shut over that black abyss. A ghastly, choking, fetid odor seemed to come from below, and the walls were wet and bloody, and covered with patches of white fungus. And worst, it was breathing. Kress stood across the room and felt the warm wind wash over him as it exhaled, and he tried not to choke, and when the wind reversed direction, he fled. Back in the living room, he destroyed 3 more mobiles and collapsed. What was happening? He didn't understand. Then he remembered the only person who might understand. Kress went to his communicator again, stepping on a Sand King in his haste, and prayed fervently that the device still worked. When Jala Wo answered, he broke down and told her everything. She let him talk without interruption. No expression save for a slight frown on her gaunt, pale face. When Kress had finished, she said only, "I ought to leave you there." Kress began to blubber. "You can't. Help me. I'll pay."
"I ought to," Wo repeated. "But I won't."
"Thank you," Kress said. "Oh, thank—"
"Quiet,"
said Wo.
"Listen to me. This is your own doing. Keep your Sand Kings well, and they are courtly ritual warriors. You turned yours into something else, with starvation and torture. You were their god. You made them what they are. That maw in your cellar is sick, still suffering from the wound you gave it. It is probably insane. Its behavior is unusual. You have to get out of there quickly. The mobiles are not dead, Kress. They are dormant. I told you the exoskeleton falls off when they grow larger. Normally, in fact, it falls off much earlier. I have never heard of Sand Kings growing as large as yours while still in the insectoid stage. It is another result of crippling the white maw, I would say. That does not matter. What matters is the metamorphosis your Sand Kings are now undergoing. As the maw grows, you see, it gets progressively more intelligent. Its psionic powers strengthen, and its mind becomes more sophisticated, more ambitious. The armored mobiles are useful enough when the maw is tiny and only semi-sentient, but now it needs better servants, bodies with capabilities. Do you understand? The mobiles are all going to give birth to a new breed of Sand King. I can't say exactly what it will look like. Each maw designs its own to fit its perceived needs and desires, but it will be biped, with 4 arms and opposable thumbs. It will be able to construct and operate advanced machinery. The individual Sand Kings will not be sentient, but the maw will be very sentient indeed. Simon Kress was gaping at Wo's image on the view screen.
"Your workers," he said with an effort. "The ones who came out here, who installed the tank."
Jala Wo managed a faint smile.
"Shade,"
she said.
"Shade is a Sand King," Kress repeated numbly. "And you sold me a tank of infants. Ah,
do not be absurd," Wo said. "A first-stage Sand King is more like a sperm than an infant. The wars temper and control them in nature. Only 1 in 100 reaches second stage. Only 1 in 1,000 achieves the third and final plateau and becomes like shade. Adult sand kings are not sentimental about the small maws. There are too many of them, and their mobiles are pests. She sighed. And all this talk wastes time. That white sand king is going to waken to full sentience soon. It is not going to need you any longer. And it hates you, and it will be very hungry. The transformation is taxing. The maw must eat enormous amounts, both before and after. So you have to get out of there. Do you understand?
I can't, Kress said. My skimmer is destroyed, and I can't get any of the others to start. I don't know how to reprogram them. Can you come out for me?
Yes, said Wo. Shade and I will leave at once. But it is more than 200 kilometers from Asgard to you, and there is equipment we will need to deal with the deranged Sand King you've created. You cannot wait there. You have 2 feet. Walk. Go due east, as near as you can determine, as quickly as you can. The land out there is pretty desolate. We'll find you easily with an aerial search, and you'll be safely away from the Sand King. Do you understand?
Yes, said Simon Kress. Yes, oh, yes.
They signed off, and he walked quickly toward the door. He was halfway there when he heard the noise, a sound halfway between a pop and a crack. One of the Sand Kings had split open. 4 tiny hands, covered with pinkish-yellow blood, came up out of the gap and began to push the dead skin aside. Kress began to run. He had not counted on the heat. The hills were dry and rocky. Kress ran from the house as quickly as he could, ran until his ribs ached and his breath was coming in gasps. Then he walked. But as soon as he had recovered, he began to run again. For almost an hour he ran and walked beneath the fierce hot sun. He sweated freely and wished that he had thought to bring some water. He watched the sky in hopes of seeing woe and shade. He was not made for this. It was too hot and too dry, and he was in no condition. But he kept himself going with the memory of the way the maw had breathed, and the thought of the wriggling little things that by now were surely crawling all over his house. He hoped woe and shade would know how to deal with them. He had his own plans for woe and shade. It was all their fault, Kress had decided, and they would suffer for it. Lysandra was dead, but he knew others in her profession. He would have his revenge. He promised himself that 100 times as he struggled and sweated his way east. At least he hoped it was east. He was not that good at directions, and he wasn't certain which way he had run in his initial panic. But since then, he had made an effort to bear due east, as Wo had suggested. When he had been running for several hours, with no sign of rescue, Kress began to grow certain that he had gone wrong. When several more hours passed, he began to grow afraid. What if Woe and Shade could not find him? He would die out here. He hadn't eaten in 2 days. He was weak and frightened. His throat was raw for want of water. He couldn't keep going. The sun was sinking now, and he'd be completely lost in the dark. What was wrong? Had the Sand Kings eaten Woe and Shade? The fear was on him again, filling him, and with it a great thirst and a terrible hunger. But Kress kept going. He stumbled now when he tried to run, and twice he fell. The second time he scraped his hand on a rock, and it came away bloody. He sucked at it as he walked and worried about infection. The sun was on the horizon behind him. The ground grew a little cooler, for which Cress was grateful. He decided to walk until last light and settle in for the night. Surely he was far enough from the Sand Kings to be safe, and woe and shade would find him come morning. When he topped the next rise, he saw the outline of a house in front of him. It wasn't as big as his own house, but it was big enough. It was habitation, safety. Cress shouted and began to run toward it. Food and drink. He had to have nourishment. He could taste the meal now. He was aching with hunger. He ran down the hill toward the house, waving his arms and shouting to the inhabitants. The light was almost gone now, but he could still make out a half-dozen children playing in the twilight. "Hey there!" he shouted. "Help! Help!" They came running toward him. Cress stopped suddenly. "No," he said. "Oh, no. Oh, no." He backpedaled, slipped on the sand, got up and tried to run again. They caught him easily. They were ghastly little things, with bulging eyes and dusky orange skin. He struggled, but it was useless. Small as they were, each of them had four arms, and Cress had only two. They carried him toward the house. It was a sad, shabby house built of crumbling sand, but the door was quite large and dark, and it breathed. That was terrible, but it was not the thing that set Simon Cress to screaming. He screamed because of the others, the little orange children who came crawling out from the castle and watched impassive as he passed. All of them had his face.